coming and speaking with friends. And today we're going to talk about the Psalms. I think you've been going through some of the Psalms this summer, is that correct? Some of the Psalms? And I love the Psalms. I pray the Psalms and read the Psalms every day. I try and read through the Psalms and pray through the Psalms at least once a month, all 150 Psalms. I try and read them and pray them in different languages if I can, in different translations. I love the Psalms. One night, I had a nightmare that somehow we lost access to the Bible. And I remember in my dream going, oh no, the Psalms! I had lost access to the Psalms, and that was the thing that really bothered me. Because the Psalms are these beautiful poems that really capture so much of human experience and human emotion. And so I love praying them through that. Sometimes you'll read and pray a psalm that just captures what you're going through in the moment. And it really is a beautiful confluence of events. But sometimes you'll read psalms where you're like, well, that's not what I'm feeling at all. But it's still good to read that and to pray that because somebody is. And there will be a time when you probably are feeling that feeling. And there's many different genres of psalms. There are the historical psalms, there are psalms of praise, there are psalms of lament, which I've spoken on here before. There are royal psalms, where it's really speaking about the king. There are messianic psalms, where it's looking forward to the king to come. And then there are some psalms that, if we're honest, probably make us quite uncomfortable. There are psalms that we would not like to repeat in polite company. There are psalms that very rarely get read out in church. And I want to talk about one of those psalms today. I want to read out Psalm 137, a psalm of rage and vengeance. So Psalm 137, if we can go to the next slide, please. By the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down, and there we wept, when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Now, this is a very sad psalm. But fascinatingly, this psalm has become one of the most popular psalms in modern Western pop culture. Do you know what I'm talking about? Are there any Boney M. fans in the room? There's a few Boney M. fans. I thought this was kind of a reggae disco kind of church. It's what it feels like from up here, is really reggae and disco. Boney M. released a version of this psalm by the rivers of Babylon back in 1979. And it is one of the top 10 all-time singles in the United Kingdom, which is very weird. It's very, very odd. I urge you to go home and listen to their version of this song. It was originally not written by them. It was written in 1970 by a reggae group called the Melodons. But Boney M. re-released it in 1979 as kind of more of a disco-y type hit. And when I first heard this version of this psalm, Psalm 137, it was strange to my ears. It's a very strange, to me, version of the song because it is reggae and it is disco and it's kind of upbeat. And it feels like it doesn't match the words of the song until you catch that it is being used as a protest song. It is actually a song originally written by the Melodons, then released by Boney M., that was defying Western oppression against the people of the Caribbean. And the members of Boney M. were from the islands. They were from Jamaica, Aruba, Montserrat. And they were using this song as a protest for the people of the Caribbean and also just for black people in general. And this is a song for people who had been enslaved, who had been exiled, who had been treated unjustly for generations. Babylon in the reggae world is a stand-in, as it was biblically, is a stand-in for unjust empire. All of the oppression that people are experiencing is basically a shortcut version of that is Babylon. That's the word that's used. And this therefore makes a lot of sense that this song comes out of the reggae world, because the psalm on which it is based is a sad and angry lament. By the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept. Why? Why were they weeping? Well, Babylon had invaded and destroyed Jerusalem and had taken most of its people into exile. The rest it had massacred. It had looted the temple and their businesses and their home and everything that they had, taken everything they had. Babylon routinely sexually assaulted the people that it conquered. It was the major power in the area. And the people of Israel, the people of Jerusalem, were being kept in captivity far away from their homeland. And they were angry. Very, very angry. As you can imagine, you would be angry. But to make things worse, their captors, their tormentors, the Babylonians, were now demanding, on top of all that, they were demanding that the people of Jerusalem sing songs about Zion. Sing songs about your homeland. Entertain us with the music about the place that you love, the place that we took from you, the place that we despoiled and destroyed. Can you see why they were angry? Wouldn't you be? So we can see why the song Rivers of Babylon is this defiant, angry protest song. That's not the first version, the first pop version of Psalm 137 that I heard, though. There is another version by an artist named Don McLean, who is more famous for writing the song American Pie. People familiar with that song? Bye, bye, Miss American Pie. So on that album, which was really only his one big album, there's a couple good songs on there. I can suggest that you go and listen to it. But one song really caught my attention, and it was The Waters of Babylon. And I loved this song. And it's around, and he just basically sings it. It's very simple. He sings it around, and he just goes, by the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept for thee, Zion. We remember thee, Zion. And that just becomes a round. And it's beautiful, and it's haunting. And I fell in love musically with this version of the song. But as I have matured, I realized that socially, historically, culturally, the Boney M. version is actually closer to the Psalms. Because Don McLean's version is sad, it is sorrowful. But Boney M.'s version and the original psalm is not just sad. It isn't just a lament. It has accusation in it. It has rage in it. And it has a desire for unbelievable vengeance in the psalm. It is angry. Let's read the last part of Psalm 137. In just a moment. Yeah, oh. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundation. So this was a neighboring nation, a neighboring people who Israel had had all kinds of history with, and on the day when the siege broke Jerusalem and it was coming down, the Edomites were cheering on the destruction of Jerusalem. And so this psalm includes, remember how they were. Remember those people, O Lord. Remember what they did. There's an accusation. And then, O daughter of Babylon, you devastator, happy are they who pay you back for what you have done to us. It's building the tension. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. Now, there's not a lot of songs about that. Other versions saying, happy is the one who dashes the heads of your children against the rocks. What do we do with that? What do we do with that desire, that level of desire for violent vengeance? So their tormentors are asking for a song, and they gave them this. This is the song they gave them. It's not even really a song. It is absolutely a violent wish to see their captors, including their children, destroyed. Now, presumably, the Babylonians didn't understand Hebrew. So this desire for vengeance in this psalm would have been a hidden sentiment. They wouldn't have known this is what they were singing. Sing us a song of Zion. Okay, we want to kill your children. La, 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 la. We'll sing you a nice song about it. And they didn't know what they were singing. It's concealed in the music. So is that sentiment in Boney M's song. The anger is concealed within the popular reggae beat. Those who knew, who had lived the history of oppression, would understand the subversive message of that song. Those who didn't, those who hadn't lived it, the oppressors, might just enjoy and buy the music. I remember being in Kentucky once, speaking at a gathering, and there was young adults there, and they had a choir, and this choir got up, and they sang this song, and the song they sang was an old spiritual. The spiritual was called Poor Lazarus, Poor Lazarus, and it's about the biblical story of the poor man who is, he's just poor, and he's living at the gate of a rich man, and he's so poor, and the rich man is ignoring him, and the dogs come and are licking his wounds, and they both die, and Lazarus goes into glory, or into the bosom of Abraham, they call it, and the rich man goes into a type of Hades, into a type of torment. And that's the story, and so there is a song written by slaves called Poor Lazarus, detailing this, and it was fascinating. As I was watching this choir of young white kids in Kentucky singing this song that was written by slaves about their ancestors. That was fascinating. And they had no idea about the history of that song. It was a surreal moment. And I think that's a bit of what's happening as we listen to the reggae disco beats of Boney M. Probably what was happening is the Babylonians were hearing this song by their captives. But now we know what's in the psalm. We know what's there. It's been translated for us. Happy are they who dash the heads of your children against rocks. What do we do with that? And one of the points I want to make is that line, happy are they who dash the heads of your children against rocks, that's biblical. When people ask the question, well, you know, is it biblical? Are we doing something biblical? Well, biblical includes this line, happy are they who dash the heads of your children against rocks. That's biblical. That might not be the only question we want to ask about our conduct. Is it biblical or not? And there are different approaches to what we do with this kind of stuff, because this is not the only violent desire for vengeance or violence that's in the Bible. So what are we going to do with it? One approach is we could just ignore it, which is how we mostly do, is we just ignore it. You only read the acceptable bits. It's kind of what I did at the beginning, right? I read Psalm 137, 1-6. That's sad. That's the Don McLean version. It's, you know, it's sorrowful, but we can deal with sorrow. We don't want to deal with the other stuff. Don't read out. Don't address the violence. Stick to the nice bits. But the problem is, it's there. It is there. It's biblical, and it's a problem. It's much bigger than the Psalms. Here's the reality. If you want to make a biblical case for violence, if you want to make a biblical case for slavery, if you want to make a biblical case for genocide, you can. You can do it. You shouldn't, but you can. People have, and people do. They continue to do that. You can say God is love, but people can point to this verse and say, well, what about that? Is that love? We can't just ignore this stuff. In the same way that we can't ignore what's going on in our own hearts when those kind of desires rise up in us. I was sharing earlier, we said we're going to talk about rage and vengeance. And someone was just kind of joking and saying, well, you know, what we do with anger, obviously, is we put it into a little, you know, bubble, and we just push it down and just wait until you die. And that's how we deal with our anger, right? That's how the Irish, and I'm Irish, that's how the Irish became wonderful drinkers, is you just take it all in a bubble and push it down and drink it away, right? That's how we do. We actually can't ignore this. Well, there's a second approach that sometimes we take, and it's to co-opt the words, to try and take the words, to make them our own. And I want to suggest this is a bad posture, because we often read these verses and other stories in Scripture from the wrong posture, from the wrong position. See, from the perspective of the exiles who wrote this psalm, this anger is totally understandable. Yeah? It's totally understandable. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying it's understandable. From the viewpoint of people who've been enslaved, who've had their lands stolen, their children starved or taken or abused or killed or bombed, from the perspective of those who have suffered under apartheid or ethnic cleansing or injustice of every kind, it is completely human and natural to feel this rage and this desire for vengeance. That's how wars happen. That's how wars continue to happen. That's how general strife happens. Is people go, well, those people did this to my family or my ancestors, therefore we must do this to them. And then the next generation, well, those people did that to my ancestors, so I must do that to them. It's vengeance, and it's vengeance, and it keeps on begetting more and more and more vengeance, but it is very extremely human that we feel that way. And it's often extremely true. They did do those things. And it is often manipulated and leveraged by those in power to get us to do other atrocities, to take vengeance. But this is very understandable and human. And what's fascinating is that the Psalms do not shy away from the expression of that feeling. When it comes from the voice of the oppressed, the exiled, the beaten, and the broken. And it must be remembered that much of that kind of messaging in the Bible was written by people who were in exile, who had had everything taken from them. But the question is that our voice? Is that our authentic voice? Christians in the modern West, for most of us, maybe just for many of us, that's not our story. That's not our reality. That's not our voice. We are not the exiled people of Jerusalem. Many of us, in fact, have been in the opposite position, in the opposite posture of those in power. And we have to take that seriously. We have been more Babylon than Israel, more colonial power than enslaved exiles. And so us co-opting and taking that language of rage and vengeance is not appropriate. Now, we might get very, very angry, and we need to talk about how to express that anger feeling, but is it right for us in every moment of anger to go, well, Psalm 137 says it's right to wish for the children of my coworker who has angered me, that I happy would be they who dash the heads of their children against rocks? Of course not. It's absurd. It's an absurdity. So we can't just take that. We can't co-opt that suffering, nor the suffering of others in the world today. That rage and violence and vengeance is not ours. So then what do we do? Well, we can try some theological gymnastics. You can try that to justify vengeance. How can we explain these truly morally indefensible words? Dash your children against rocks. Now, I assure you that people are doing this today. They are finding ways to say that this is right, that this is okay. Believe me when I tell you that there are teachers, books, seminary courses devoted to explaining exactly why this is justifiable, why the killing of children is justifiable, why it must, in fact, be loving. Because God is love. Therefore, it must be good, somehow, loving, somehow, to want this. And if the need arises, to actually do this. Again, slavery, genocide, killing babies. All of this gets justified. The worst abuses in human history have been justified, and they have been justified biblically. A Pew Forum in 2009 reported that 18% of North American white evangelicals said that the use of torture against suspected terrorists can often be justified. 44% of white evangelicals said it can sometimes be justified. That means 62% of white evangelicals in North America said that torture can be justified. Now, many evangelicals are against it, of course. But it was the only grouping of people in the entire forum that even came out with a positive result. It was evangelicals who said, yes, it is right to so abuse and despoil and humiliate and destroy the body of a child of God. We must be allowed to do this. It is sometimes justifiable. That should horrify us. But let's go deeper. Let's get real current. There is an extremist politician in Israel a few months ago who said, and I'm quoting, "The enemy is not Hamas, nor is it the military wing of Hamas. Every child in Gaza is the enemy. Not a single Gazan child will be left there. There is no other victory." Now, I know that in bringing up Israel-Palestine, I am playing hopscotch on a minefield. But should I be? When we hear something like that, in the name of Christ, can we not say, absolutely not? Can we agree that we should not justify the killing of children? Can we agree in the name of Christ that that is not right? That it's not right when Hamas does it. It's not right when Israel does it. It's not right when Russia does it. It's not right when Canada did it to indigenous children for generations. It's not right. Can we not confess this? That it's not okay. And again, not as a political or a military thing, but simply as a Christian thing, can we not say that this is not the way of Christ? And if we do agree with that, doesn't it bring us back to an uncomfortable discussion about Psalm 137? If we have a hard time imagining Christ saying that that's what should happen, what do we do with Psalm 137? Well, I just think we have to come back to the words and the way of Jesus. See, the Bible is actually an extremely complicated thing. It really, really is. And it has stuff in there that without help, we're going to get wrong. We need a teacher. We need a rabbi. We have one. Jesus is our rabbi. He is the lens through which we need to read the scriptures. We must not let the Bible interpret Jesus for us. We must let Jesus interpret the Bible for us. That is what happens on the Emmaus Road after his resurrection. He is interpreting the scriptures to his disciples. Jesus is our way in. Well, what is the way of Jesus? Jesus goes way, way further than even I would necessarily go. Jesus says, instead of crushing the heads of enemies, I will offer myself to my enemies to be crushed. There is no sense in which Jesus says, happy are they who dash the heads of your children against rocks. He says, I am the child of God, and I will be dashed against the rocks for you, my enemies. It is human to say, dash the heads of the children against rocks. It is Christ-like to say, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. It is human to hate your enemy. It is Christ-like to say, love your enemy. And Christ is what God is like. Now, it may very well be that in this psalm, the psalmist is writing not about actual flesh and blood children, but about the powers and the principalities, about Babylon as a system, as a nation, and its children are all the things that it's doing. May we destroy it? Okay, maybe. But we have taken that and we've turned it into flesh and blood. So what do we do with it? What do we do with this kind of anger, rage, and vengeance? First, we don't ignore it. Don't ignore it in the scriptures. Don't ignore it in yourself. We must feel and acknowledge these things. Have you ever felt extremely angry about something and then went, oh, no, no, I'm not supposed to feel like that? Anyone ever do that? Yeah. What if instead we were to say, I feel really angry about that. Jesus, would you help me? It is something we can do. We're allowed to do it. And it's better than just ignoring it. Don't co-opt the story. Hear the sorrow and the angers of others. And don't just go, well, that's very much like my situation. No, hear what people have gone through. If you have a chance, listen to indigenous elders. Listen to their story. Listen to what they have to say about what happened to them. I was in another grouping once where I was speaking alongside an indigenous elder, and somebody from the group, this was down in Oklahoma, someone from the group said, oh, why do we have to think about all this stuff that just happened in history? Why can't we all just be colorblind and just get along with each other as Jesus wants? And my friend was just so gracious that she said, no, you don't understand. It was my children were taken away. I'm not talking about 120 years ago. My children were taken away. And she says, I'm terrified right now being in this room with 100 white people because you're in between me and the door. And I'm really scared of you. They couldn't grasp that. They didn't know what to do with that. She's like, I'm so scared of you. But Aaron says you're okay. I'm like, I do not vouch for these people. I don't know. I don't know if they're okay or not. He says you're okay, so I'm here. Her grace and wisdom was profound. Listen to people who have walked through that, who have every understandable right to be enraged and wanting vengeance, and yet are speaking wisdom and grace into the world. Listen. Don't seek vengeance, but we can pray this prayer. We can pray this prayer against the powers and the principalities, the systems that oppress our world, militarism, the greed, the vengeance, the violence, those kind of systems that are destroying the very children of God. We can pray against it. I pray against them regularly. I pray that they are overthrown and cast down, and that all of their children, all of the things that would come out of these powers and these principalities, these organizations, these demonic forces would be destroyed, would be overturned. And I can do that because that is the way of Christ. Christ was violent. Who was he violent to? When he cast unclean spirits out of children and other people, he was violent towards them. He said, "Get out." And they got out. Where else was he violent? He was violent in the temple. He was violent at the overturning of this system, which was hurting people and destroying people. And he drove the moneylenders out. And the same word is used for his driving the moneylenders out as is used for his driving the demonic spirits out. He is exorcising the temple. We can pray against the systems, against the powers, against the principalities. And we can pray in confidence, because it says that Jesus has overcome them. He has defeated them and he's put them at his feet. He's humiliated the powers and the principalities. We can pray with confidence in that. But we cannot pray or act this out against human children, the children of God, and call it Christ-like. I have a friend I met in Syria who said he'd become a believer when he was a child, and he'd heard the teaching of Jesus that he should pray for his enemies. And so he said to me, "That is why every single day I pray for Israel." And there was a jarring moment. He said, "Because it's not just theoretically. They have sent rockets into my hometown many times. They are quite literally my enemy, militarily, politically, culturally. They are my enemy. They've killed people that I know and love. But I am told to pray for my enemies, so I pray for them." But it goes even deeper than that, because in that grouping, they were asking, "How do we pray for ISIS?" This particular church was on the list. They knew that people had their names on a list and they were wanting to come and kill this people in this church. And I was telling them the story of Paul and Ananias, where Paul is heading towards Damascus in Syria, and he gets met by the Lord, and he's blinded, and he's stumbling towards Damascus. And I said, "Can you imagine?" I lost my head here. I said, "Can you imagine hearing that somebody was heading towards Damascus wanting to kill you?" And all of them said, "Yeah, we can." We can just about imagine that. They lived in Damascus. They knew that people were trying to come and kill them. And he said, "And God told Ananias, go out and meet this Saul and welcome him in." And Ananias was scared to do it, because Saul wanted to come and kill him. That's all he knew. But Ananias said he would. And I said, "How many here who would go and welcome? Who would go, if you were told by the Lord to go and welcome your oppressor in, who would do it?" And there was silence. And then one man stood up and he said, "Ana." And "Ana" in Arabic is "I." And then one by one, all the members of this Syrian church whose names were on the hit list stood up and just said, "Ana, Ana, Ana, Ananias." They are modern Ananias. They have internalized and are embodying the way of Christ in so many ways, but in particular, in the way of love towards your enemy. I want to end just by putting up the words of the Boney M. song. We can get it up there. This is the first verse. "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. When the wicked carried us away in captivity, required from us a song. Now how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? That's Psalm 137. But what's fascinating is there's a second verse that's taken from Psalm 19. Let's put that up. Let the words of our mouth and the meditations of our heart be acceptable in thy sight here tonight. What if just that could be the words that flavored our rage and desire for vengeance? We can say, yeah, it's human, I'm angry, but oh Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, oh Jesus Christ, who when I was still an enemy, died for me. We're going to remember that now as we take up communion. And I'm going to read out a passage that we normally don't associate with communion. But I want us, as we receive the body and the blood of the Lord, the sacrifice that he made for us to bring reconciliation to the whole world, peace between us and God and peace between us and our brothers and sisters, can we take it also on behalf of the children in our world today who are suffering, who don't know if they're going to eat today, who don't know if they're going to be bombed today, who do not understand and have no part in the violence of the world? Can we care for their body, for their flesh, for their blood today, as we remember the body and the blood of our Lord? Then little children were brought to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. And Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." When he had placed his hands on them, he went on from there. Let's receive the body and the blood together.